wait a minute, we were essentially denied our constitutional right to a fair trial.
We can give at least some measure of peace to their families who've lost so much.
Certain crimes are considered crimes of moral turpitude.
Whether or not a case can continue to be heard in a court really is a matter of state law.
The whole system has to be thrown out.
The truth needs to be told.
According to the Sentencing Project, 6.1 million Americans are not eligible to vote because of a felony conviction. Some are still in prison, but nearly 4 million have served their sentences and in their attempt to re-enter society find themselves barred from participating in the most basic civic duty. This week, our friends at the Marshall Project take a look at a case filed just last month in Alabama that challenges a provision of the state constitution that allows election registrars to determine voter eligibility for those with a felony conviction based on their own interpretation of what constitutes a crime of, quote, moral turpitude. I'm joined by Andrew Cohen, commentary editor for the Marshall Project and author of the Case in Point series, and Danielle Lang, the deputy director of voting rights at the Campaign Legal Center. Andrew says Alabama's process for re-including veterans into civic life turns out to be a very public humiliation at the hands of some low-level bureaucrats.
Alabama is one of those states that does allow ex-offenders to vote in certain circumstances. And so what you have to do if you've been convicted is you basically apply for registration. You try to register to vote. Basically, the registrar makes a decision based on what your criminal record may be. Certain crimes are considered crimes of moral turpitude. Certain other crimes are not considered crimes of moral turpitude. That phrase is in the Alabama Constitution. And so the problem is that different registrars in different counties have different interpretations about what constitutes a crime of moral turpitude. And you have all these people in the state who have served their time, whether it's been prison or probation or parole. They're trying to re-enter society, and they're trying to vote to become productive members of society. And in certain circumstances, there's no rhyme or reason to why they're being denied the right to vote. For example, you have people who have committed property theft. Many people would not consider that an immoral crime, relatively speaking, and yet those people are being disenfranchised, and that's why this lawsuit was filed last month, essentially saying the whole system has to be thrown out and Alabama has to start again.
Danielle Lang, is there any way of telling what the Constitution wanted to achieve in this screening? Are there particular people who would obviously meet the test of moral turpitude and who would be not eligible to vote?
Well, it is pretty clear what the Constitution wanted to achieve at the time. The language moral turpitude and the disenfranchisement of individuals who've been convicted of crimes, quote unquote, involving moral turpitude, actually dates directly back to the 1901 Alabama Constitution. The drafters were very clear that what they were trying to establish was maintaining white supremacy. That's what they said. And when they were devising the felon disenfranchisement system, they had that specific goal in mind. So by using a vague catch-all term like moral turpitude, they could decide on a case-by-case basis who was allowed to vote based on a criminal conviction and who was not.
Can you give me a sense of the disparities of the kinds of crimes who were approved, and if there is a clear racial distinction between individuals who have felony records of one kind of crime who were allowed to vote and others who weren't, and if their ethnicity had anything to do with it?
The record keeping is just not very good on that, but I can tell you that at the time that this was devised, almost 99% of all of Alabama's prisoners were black. So the criminal justice system at that time was specifically targeting black citizens. And so in the 1901 Constitution, they also had language like wife beating, for example. And one of the drafters said, oh, well, that'll definitely take care of most of the blacks. Now, of course, that wasn't because he thought that that was a crime disproportionately committed by black people, but that that was one that was often used to convict black people in Alabama at that time.
I guess I'm a little bit shocked that something like this, a completely arbitrary judgment could be made of someone with a felony conviction at the time of registration, and that there could be such a clear record of racial discrimination going back to 1901. Andrew Cohen, I mean, it seems like this could have been struck down, you know, decades ago.
Yeah, it does, John. I mean, one of the things that struck me is the story of a woman who's actually not a named plaintiff, who was able to get some relief because she ultimately was pardoned. You have a woman who committed a crime, who served whatever the punishment was, and was able to register to vote in a particular county. And there was no problem. She got her registration, and that was that. And then she moved to another county, to Madison County. And when she moved, she was then denied. So not only do you have this racial disparity that I think exists, but you have county-by-county arbitrariness when it comes to enforcing what is supposed to be a state mandate.
I would like to clarify something that I think makes the system even more broken, which is that even to apply to register in Alabama, you have to sign an application that says under penalty of perjury that you have not been convicted of a quote-unquote disqualifying felony. Well, there are a couple things about that. One, as I read it, I would assume that that means that all felonies are disqualifying. But even if I understood that it was supposed to be more limited, there's no way that I could know whether or not my criminal conviction was disqualifying or not. And there is a threat of penalty of perjury if I turn out to be wrong about that decision, which is, frankly, as we've been discussing, an arbitrary one. And so I think that catch-22 for a lot of people with criminal convictions means that very few people are even applying out of fear, even though they may very well be eligible to vote.
In terms of national trends, Andrew Cohen, are states getting away from banning individuals with felony records from voting?
Slowly, John, slowly. Usually governors have broad power to grant pardons or clemency or other relief that gives ex-offenders the right to vote. It's happening in Virginia. This lawsuit is in Alabama. There are other states where we're seeing a little bit of movement. And it sort of goes in line with the Ban the Box movement, which is the movement that does have some national chops to make it easier for ex-offenders to get employment. So there is a movement in that direction, but it's very slow. And in some areas of the country, it's going to be much more difficult than in other areas.
Andrew Cohen is commentary editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point, a biweekly column which sheds light on a single case or character from the criminal justice system. And it's our focus this week. Danielle Lang is the deputy director of voting rights for the Campaign Legal Center. Thanks so much, Danielle and Andrew.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.